It's Sam Cedar. Introducing whiny-ass, teeny-baby conservatives to the truth. Wow, wow, conservatives. That's you crying. The left just got a little bit louder on The Majority Report.
Oh, isn't that lovely? It is Tuesday. Tuesday, November 23rd, 2010. This is The Majority Report. I am Sam Cedar, broadcasting to you live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in central Manhattan. Are we in Midtown?
Yes. I think this is Midtown, yeah.
Are we South Midtown, or we are sort of like Hell's Kitchen, right?
I don't know. This is like the middle of Midtown.
Yeah,
right?
It's about as middle as it gets.
We don't know where we
Times
are,
Square.
Folks. That John Benjamin liner, I hadn't heard that one in a long time. It is hilarious, particularly because right now I don't think we have many conservatives listening.
That's true.
We probably have. I know that we have one. Because I get these weird emails from him. But I don't know that we have two. But soon, we have plans, ladies and gentlemen. We have plans, plans that we can't tell you. Secret plans. Secret plans to expand our offering to conservatives as well as to liberals and moderates and centrists and corporatists. But for now, it's actually not working to keep it too exclusive. We have, via podcast, thousands listening. And I would imagine if we keep going at this rate that we will have tens of thousands within a couple of weeks. Not quite as many members. People have signed up for membership things. Talking to Marin the other day, he still has multiple more times of members than we do. That's an outrage. That is an outrage that Marc Maron would have more members than I would. I guess he calls them donors. But it's an outrage, ladies and gentlemen. It cannot stand. It cannot stand, and you can make the difference. On the program today, Ari Berman will be joining us. You know, I'm going to have to play Myla's diarrhea song. I'm going to get that on my 360. Whenever John Benjamin calls me, that's the ringtone. Because Myla loves to sing about John Benjamin's diarrhea. Later in the program, did I say Ari Berman will be with us? Ari Berman will be with us. I got, you know, let me just go through one, a couple of the means in which you can communicate with us during the show live. You can hashtag at MajorityFM, hashtag on Twitter. You can IM us at MajorityFM. If you're not following us at MajorityFM on Twitter, please do. Please do. Citizen DK reminds us that Friday is Buy Nothing Day. You can't spell buy, but it is Buy Nothing Day. That is also known as Black Friday. This is the day that retail outlets essentially go into the black for the year because they sell off a lot of their inventory starting at this time. So they call it Black Friday. Being in the black means that you're in net positive territory. When we say around here it's Black Friday, we're referring to it in the other way, that we're not yet in net positive territory. But for the rest of corporate America, which you'll be happy to know, folks, despite the fact that we have continuing 9.5, 9.6 unemployment, if that's even remotely close to the real number of what unemployment is, despite the fact that we have plunging household net values because of the housing market, despite the fact that we have unemployment benefits that have now been stopped by the Republican Party, despite the fact that we have the Republicans agitating and perhaps the Democrats caving on providing tax cuts for millionaires. New York Times reports the nation's workers may be struggling, but American companies just had their best quarter ever. Ever. American businesses earned profits of $1.66 trillion.
Ooh.
At an annual rate, that's annualized relative to the third quarter. This is according to the Commerce Department. That's the highest figure recorded since the government began keeping track over 60 years ago. This breakneck pace can be partly attributed to strong productivity growth. In other words, we've been able to lay off so many workers and squeeze our existing workers more that our profits go up. That's actually what I'm trying to get going on around here. Dorsey, are you even awake?
Yes, I'm awake.
Okay. And then, of course, as well as the fact that some of the profits of American companies come from abroad. Come from abroad. Why does that... Oh, I know what it is. One of the big tax changes I think the Republicans want is for American corporations to repatriate their profits from abroad at 0% tax rate. Now, you remember what U.S. corporations are doing who make all this money abroad, what many of them are doing, is they keep their profits over there and essentially hide it maintain it in banks over there or maintain it in, you know, capital improvements over there by being abroad. To avoid U.S. tax rates, of course, they had a one-time moratorium back in, I think it was 2003, by the Bush administration, called the American Jobs Creation Act. Guess what, folks? It didn't create any jobs.
Surprise.
And so all that happened was that U.S. corporations got to repatriate their profits at something like a 5 or 4% tax rate as opposed to a 10% tax rate.
Wait, check. 1, 2. Check. Let me just get this. Okay.
Folks, forgive us. We had a little technical problem. We are back on. We seem to be working. This is a backup computer because Evan broke the other one. And that's all right. This is what happens, folks. It's a startup. And...
hard lunch.
Let's go. I'm going to call Ari Berman right now. We'll bring Ari Berman in, and we'll backload it. So what we're going to do is play a little music while you wait for us.
Sound.
Oh, you sound great, buddy.
I'd expect nothing less.
All right.
Where are you broadcasting from?
Well, I'm... That's a great question, Ari. That's a great way to start off the interview. I am broadcasting from the shadow, the literal shadow, like I say, not the metaphorical shadow, of the New York Times building, just around the corner from the Port Authority.
From beautiful Port Authority.
Exactly. And during the day, our crew is selling umbrellas, or maybe they've scammed a bunch of newspapers or selling some newspapers to people who come off the bus. And that's the way we are supplementing this program. But I should start by saying on the phone is Ari Berman. He is a contributing writer for The Nation magazine. He is also an investigative journalism fellow at the Nation Institute. Are you a Puffin fellow?
I was. No, I'm no longer.
Oh, all right. Well, you graduated. You've actually, you're post-Puffin.
I've moved on from the Puffin era.
And, of course, his writings have appeared in the New York Times and The Guardian. And he is the author of, which I am, well, I was holding in my hand, but now the computer is on top of it. Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics. It's a great read, and in some ways it's sort of, well, I mean, it's sentimental in some ways. It's fascinating, and it's a little bit depressing, but it seems like to me everything's depressing these days.
So that's, I guess that's a question, right?
Well, I mean, do you agree? No, first of all, let me just say this. I don't mean to undersell the book, because the book is it's incredibly fascinating, both to sort of basically to see this process of how Howard Dean gelled something in the Democratic Party, and Obama then and obviously it's not just these individuals, it's the people around them. Names that many people would recognize from the Netroots, how Obama sort of like took this as a roadmap in some respects, and then leaves us,
and then abandoned it,
and then abandoned it.
I guess that's probably the more depressing part of the story. I mean, it is interesting. The story I wanted to tell was this birth of a new political era, and how Dean sort of unexpectedly came upon a new political model, which took him a long way and excited a lot of people during his presidential campaign. And even though he famously crashed and burned in Iowa and there was a scream and all of that, you know, he came back as chairman of the party and really figured out how to reinvent a political party, how to do anti-establishment politics in the ultimate establishment position. And I think that was something that the Obama campaign really built on when they had to run against the Clinton campaign, which at that point had, you know, all the establishment support, all the money, all of that. And but what happens is, you know, after the 2008 election, this really forms the last third of the book, is, you know, Obama, for all the talk of being grassroots and for all the talk of having a new political model and really changing the way campaigns are done, but also the way that governance is done, he really forms a much more, I think, conventional White House than I think people expected, and relies on a lot of the very players and the very people that he ran against. In fact, he makes all these arguments during the campaign about, you know, you have to have the right kind of experience, basically implying that the Clinton people and the Bush people had the wrong kind of inside the Beltway experience, but then for whatever reason, he relies on them and demobilizes his grassroots movement at the very moment that the right starts energizing their base. And so you had this situation that's almost like asymmetric warfare, right, where one side has a big rifle and the other side's just unloaded all their ammo and it isn't even bringing anything to the party. And so, I mean, I think that's really the essential dynamic of the last election. That's basically where we're at today.
Right. And, you know, I have two areas that I'm just fascinated that your book essentially sort of tees up. And one is that on some level, there are these cross currents to the left right spectrum of ideology. Yeah. And the cross current is this, and you break it out, I think, as insurgent versus the establishment, outsider versus insider.
Mm-hmm.
that element, that outsider versus insider, this insurgent versus establishment in the context of a campaign, one could say at this point the average American, you know, and I'm speaking definitionally in terms of money, which really constitutes 90% of Americans, versus an incredibly concentrated economic elite in terms of what's dictating our policies. That seems to be the really fascinating paradigm that I think in retrospect we see that was happening in these in that campaign with Howard Dean and in some ways projected upon Obama and in his campaign.
Yeah. No, and then you see it in the Tea Party too. I mean, it's interesting how the Dean people were very, very angry at the Democratic establishment in Washington, who they viewed as, you know, being far too accommodating of George W. Bush and his agenda, primarily on the war in Iraq, but also on the tax cuts and a host of other fronts. And they really felt like they wanted someone with a spine who would challenge the Republican ascendancy, would challenge Karl Rove in the Bush era. And it just so happened that Dean came along, and he was that guy. And he was sort of an ill-fitting leader, but he nonetheless was the guy who was willing to articulate that message and say the emperor has no clothes. Obama didn't quite do that. I mean, he was always much more conciliatory than Dean was, but I think in his own subtle way, he made some similar arguments about, you know, needing new voices, needing new perspectives, not just relying on the same old crew of people to get the job done. And I very much think the Tea Party totally picked up the Dean mantle. I mean, they were very angry with the Republican establishment in Washington, and there was very much a sense that the Republicans in power didn't speak for them. Now, I think it's a little bit more complicated with the Tea Party because I think they've been manipulated along the way by the Republican establishment. I think a lot of Republicans just rebranded themselves as Tea Partiers, whereas Dean was bringing a lot of new people into politics. It's unclear to me how many new people there are. But nonetheless, there are some similarities in terms of certainly the positioning of them, and then Obama kind of runs as this insurgent candidate and then gets in there and starts acting like the establishment. And I think that really hurt him in 2010 and in the midst of an economic crisis.
Right. Well, okay. And that's the second question that is so fascinating about that, because I think, you know, more, I mean, for me, speaking personally for me, more than imposing a projection of his ideology on Obama, you know, I didn't perceive him as a screaming liberal. That to me would have been... That to me would have been an amazing bonus, and it certainly was enhanced by the idea that, like, hey, when the whole Reverend Wright stuff came out, I was like, this is what my secret hope is.
Yeah, you were the one guy who cheered.
Right. I was the guy who was like, this is fantastic. I hope he's this guy. But the one thing that I thought, you know, at the end of the day, in terms of like what was clear, was that this guy was not part of the establishment. And that he had such a burning, and this is the part that it was very hard for me to, it's still very hard for me to reconcile. He has a burning urgency to leap ahead of the establishment, right? I mean, if he was an establishment player, he would have waited 8 years because he could have easily done that. But he had such a burning need to get there now, which walked like an insurgent, talk like an insurgent, and then he comes in and he becomes immediately this establishmentarian. How was it that he was able to fake this? Was he faking this? Is this, you know, because we see people refer to, and you talk about it in, you know, Howard Dean's perspective on Democrats as being too accommodating and capitulating. And we use verbs or adverbs, you know, like caving and weakness and cowardice. But is it really that, or is it that this is their agenda in some way?
Well, this is really a good question, and something that's hard to know, in fact, what's going on inside his psychology. I mean, if you look at Obama in Chicago, for example, he was never totally of the establishment, but he was certainly on good terms with it. I mean, the Daily Machine there, they never really adopted him as one of their own, but nonetheless, he was very close with a lot of main people in that machine, including David Axelrod and including Rahm Emanuel. But, I mean, when he ran for president, he was incentivized, I think, to be more creative and to be more of an insurgent because he was running against the Clintons. And I think after that campaign, some of those incentives dried up. I think he thought, you know, I'm a relatively inexperienced leader. I have a ton of crises that I need to solve, you know, not the least of which was the economic crisis, which he didn't really anticipate when he ran for president. And he started thinking, well, I don't really know how to solve these problems. And the people that I need to solve them are unfortunately the people that have worked on them before. And so that gives us Larry Summers, and that gives us Tim Geithner, and that gives us Bob Gates, and that gives us Hillary Clinton, and all these usual suspects who remain in power. And, I mean, my basic thing was that he didn't really have faith in the ability of either himself or all the people that he brought with him in the campaign.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty stunning.
Yeah, that he'd figure out how to get them part of government. Basically, he didn't seem to buy his own argument. I mean, and you could basically say, well, the argument was a con job in the first place. I don't think it was. I just think it was that, you know, circumstances changed and he pivoted emphasis. And unfortunately, you know, he pivoted it at the very moment when it mattered most, when he actually was in power and he actually could do something. And in fact, I would argue that the message that he came in with during the campaign of change, of being outside of Washington, of being in the insurgent, was the exact message that would have played perfectly in the midst of an economic crisis. But by embracing the status quo, by embracing the establishment, he really gave the right an opening to do this version of outside the beltway populism, which I thought otherwise Democrats would be able to really master.
Right.
But they ceded that playing field. They ceded that ground to the Tea Party.
Completely. And people knew it at the time.
Yeah.
I mean, that was what was so shocking about it. People knew that he was ceding this ground. And, you know, I mean, I, for one, happen to think that it was a mistake from day one not to really focus on assigning blame. I mean, even if you have a month of doing that and you move on, you know, they still apparently hadn't learned the lesson that it doesn't matter. You know, you cannot play to your critics because those critics are going to do exactly the same thing. You know, whether you make it a little bit easier or harder, they're going to get to the same place. So let me ask you this: if your theory is correct, why is it seemingly so hard? And now we're just talking on a political level, because on a policy level, that seems to be, that ship has sailed. There's nothing new on, at least in terms of a legislative agenda, that is possible at this point.
No, yeah.
So why not on a rhetorical level? What do you anticipate, if your theory is correct, what do you anticipate will there be a rhetorical pivot? I mean, there's no evidence of one now, as far as I can tell.
There is no evidence of it. I mean, basically, there's two strands of thought right now among Democrats and among progressives. And I think, you know, among establishment Democrats, really, the debate is, okay, well, we lost the election because we lost independent voters and Republicans, and we lost them because we seemed like tax and spend liberals. And so really what we have to do is we have to focus on the deficit, and we have to cooperate with Republicans, and we have to pull a Clinton, and that thus will get people back on our side, some of these swing voters and Republicans and independents back on their side. I mean, that seems to be the conventional wisdom in D.C. right now, and that seems to be what Obama himself is embracing.
Oh.
The other point of view is which I am more sympathetic to, is basically saying we lost our base, we didn't inspire them, we didn't turn them out, we made a whole series of bad deals which didn't get us Republican support, didn't get us independent support, and it cost us our most loyal supporters. And really what we need to do better is we need to have a more bold agenda, particularly on the economy, lay that out, be ready to defend it, and then draw the contrast between that agenda and the GOP, and really give up on the whole notion of bipartisan cooperation, because the GOP ain't cooperating. And basically say, okay, here's what we're willing to fight for going forward. Here's what we'll fight for if we can get, you know, reelected. Because I think that's what was missing in the last election, was any sort of affirmative Democratic agenda. I mean, no one was running on anything. I mean, their basic argument was, we're not Bush.
Right. In fact, and they didn't even make that argument well, frankly, because nobody had been talking about Bush for the past 2 years.
Nobody had been talking about Bush, and the American public elected Obama, I think, to turn the page on Bush, so they didn't really want to go back there. They said, okay, we know you're not Bush, but what have you done? And, you know, he either was unable to defend his agenda because the agenda substantively was just not popular, or he just was not willing to defend it for whatever reason, but it just didn't seem like there was a very substantive defense going on, and I don't think they laid out what they would do differently, and I still think they don't. It's hard to say what they would do differently. I mean, you had a perfect example on the Bush tax cuts, for example, where you could have extended them before that. You could have extended everyone but the tax cuts for the wealthy before they left. They didn't do it. You could have done it in a lame duck Congress. They're not willing to do that, and now they're basically sucked into this position where even though they control the presidency in the Senate, they're going to let the House Republicans dominate this entire agenda and extend all the tax cuts, which is totally going to box Obama in for the next few years. And so, I mean, I'm not really sure, you know, what it's going to take to break through.
Well, all right. Now, let me offer an alternative theory and get your take on this, because you're talking about failures of political tactic and strategy. When you talk about this vote on extending the tax cuts, when you talk about a lack of fundamental change in terms of, you know, those forces that influence our government and our markets and whatnot.
Yeah.
Now, yesterday I had on the program Jacob Hacker.
Yeah.
And I know you're familiar with his book, Winner Take All Politics.
Yeah,
I imagine a gentleman as well-versed as you has already read that book. But even if you haven't...
I haven't read it yet, partly because I've been on book tour.
I understand. You don't have to justify this to me. But the premise is essentially that both parties are in some, I mean, I think Republicans, it's sewn into the fabric of who they are, but that the Democratic Party has been, in some respects, captured by the same big money forces, corporate forces, and that we're getting a policy that reflects that. Mm-hmm. And is it possible that the issue isn't that simply that Obama and some of the Democratic leadership, because I don't think this is true of all Democrats, but that some of the Democratic leadership is, in fact, has certain areas where they can, where they are basically following what their big donors want them to follow, which makes the political rhetoric and the political moves that you and I think are quite obvious for the Democrats to take impossible, because if they did have that vote to just extend middle class tax cuts, it would make it very difficult to extend tax cuts for millionaires at this point. And so maybe that, you know, there's not one person pulling all the levers here, but that there are such forces on the Democratic Party that are operating that it makes it impossible for either a proactive agenda that it would help the middle class to the and not benefit money, big money, makes it impossible to actually carry that out. And yes, that has political implications, but at the end of the day, the people who are pulling those, the people who are sort of standing in the way of those actions are feel like they're incentivized to do so.
Well, it's hard to know if the party is doing things because, A, as you mentioned, they're just bought off like everybody else, a lot of leaders, or they're just very insecure about touching issues like taxes that they don't think they can win rhetorically. You know, so it's hard to know what's really motivating them, but I think it is true that, basically there's an incredible amount of money and influence that has polluted the political system for a very long time. It's only gotten worse now with the Citizens United decision, and basically both parties have fallen victim to it. Republicans have fallen victim to it worse, but it doesn't mean that Democrats aren't culpable either. And that's why I found Obama's message during the campaign to be so intriguing. But basically what he was arguing is, yes, both parties are bought off. And what's going to make me different is I'm going to have this grassroots army that right. isn't bought off, and that they are going to form a parallel force doing pressure politics that can fight these entrenched interests that have been blocking change for so long. And I would argue that most of the base, most of the young people, a lot of the Rainbow Coalition that support Obama were not bought off. They actually, you know, were uniquely inspired. They were politically naive,
right?
But they were definitely inspired. And there was no real effort, I don't think, to get them involved in the running of Washington. I mean, when Obama wanted something done, for example, with a Democratic member of Congress, it was all backdoor negotiations. He never unleashed his supporters on Max Baucus, for example,
right.
during the health care debate. There was none of that. And it's funny because that's what the Tea Party did. I mean, they totally unleashed themselves on Republicans, defeated them in primaries, and really went after a lot of people. And they were hardcore conservatives, and they basically didn't apologize for it.
Well,
if anything,
Obama didn't even
honor.
Unleash his supporters on Collins or Snow.
That's what I'm saying. I mean,
they didn't force Democrats to get in line, and they didn't even go after Republicans.
Not with any sort of teeth. And so, I mean, basically, that was his biggest asset. And if you see that card, then what do you have left? Then you're basically just a relatively inexperienced leader who hasn't been on Capitol Hill for that long, who hasn't been in Washington for that long, and the old school politicians there feel like they can play you. And that's basically what happened. I mean, he got played by members of his own party during health care, and he's gotten played by the GOP on the tax cut issue. And so, I mean, that's why it seems to me like they're never going to win this inside the Beltway game. That's not his strength. And I would basically abandon it if I was him.
Right.
And,
well, why can't he see this?
Well, I mean, I think what he's trying to do is he's trying to see where he can cooperate with Republicans, and if the Republicans won't cooperate, he's trying to set up a rhetorical situation where he says, look, I tried and they won't cooperate, and thus I'm not to blame. It's basically like he's trying to give himself political cover at the moment.
But from whom? I mean, who at this point – see, this is the part that sort of just befuddles me. I mean, who does he think he can convince of that dynamic that isn't already convinced? In other words, is there a threshold? Does he think that, like, that David Brooks or David Broder is going to go, like, yep, I actually see it now. Obama really has put his hand out there, and the Republicans have slapped it away. I mean, is there anybody out there who either, you know, who's up in the air about this? I mean, either you believe at this point the Republicans are never going to compromise, or you will never admit otherwise. Right? I mean, is there even
It seems clear to us, but the administration seems to believe that that message is not breaking through, that people don't see Republicans as being as obstructionist, or put it this way, maybe they saw them being obstructionist, but they didn't care in the last Congress because Democrats had the majority and they just expected Democrats to do what they would do. Now that Republicans have the House, they feel like maybe they'll be more weight on the GOP to actually have to deliver, and that's if
completely
they don't
insane.
Cooperate.
It's completely.
I agree with you. I mean, I basically think the stimulus set the tone. When they put a third of the tax cuts in the stimulus
right.
and they didn't get any Republican votes, I think it should have been pretty clear that these guys are not on board. That it's not in their. It's not really in their self-interest, quite frankly, to be on board. I mean,
well, it's
they
not
don't
being
succeed
made.
If
I mean,
Obama
look,
succeeds,
you can. Right.
I mean, the GOP. I mean, they made a calculation that basically that their best way back in power was to stymie everything Obama did,
right.
and that worked.
Right.
Democrats got blamed for the gridlock. Democrats got blamed for the bad economy, and Democrats lost all the seats in 2010, basically because Republicans were able to make Washington look completely dysfunctional, and Democrats looked like weren't able to fight back. They just sort of seemed like they were whining.
Well, the problem, I actually think that the problem was is that the reason why that gridlock and obstructionist strategy worked was because the Democrats did not get. Why? Well, we're not aggressive enough by in creating a rhetorical distinction. You know,
yeah.
I mean, I was on MSNBC with Jonathan Alter, I don't know, maybe a month ago, and, you know, made the comment that all of us who are considered dirty and naive, that Obama should have asked for a bigger stimulus. he shot back with a literally. I mean, almost like a comedic, condescension. He had talked to Senate staffers, and there was no way that was going to get through. And I said, well, here you have Obama now trying to do his $50 billion infrastructure bill, which, of course, is not going to go anywhere.
No.
But had he made the argument at that time that we need $1.5
trillion
and had ended up at the same place or even less, right? I mean, let's say worst case scenario, he gets $100 billion less than he wants because he asked for $1.5 trillion instead of $800 billion. I don't know how that works, but just, stipulate that. He would be able to come back and say, see, I told you we needed $1.5 trillion. But instead...
Well, that's what Bush did on the tax cuts. I mean, Bush introduced massive, massive tax cuts bill, let the Democrats take a little bit out of it, and then basically said, I compromised, when in fact he pretty much got everything he wanted. And it's funny, can you imagine what Bush would have done with the majority he had in the House and a 60-vote majority in the Senate? I mean, it's really inconceivable. I mean, he passed – both Reagan and Bush never had more than 55
right.
Republican seats in the Senate, and no one accused them of being insufficiently bold. But Democratic presidents, they just seem to feel like they cannot sell their agenda for whatever reason, and they water everything down from the very beginning. I mean, the public option should
have been compromised. Here's the real question, though. I mean, Ari, is it that they don't feel they can sell their agenda, or is it really part of their agenda?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think on the healthcare bill, it's more of that. It was really not part of their agenda because, I mean, basically they felt like the only way they could get the healthcare bill through was to cut deals with everybody. And that would mean, cutting all these deals with corporate interests and by definition that they would sacrifice a lot of the progressive change that maybe they didn't want, but certainly the base wanted in terms of doing that. It's really hard to know. I mean, we can't sort of look into Obama's soul and know, is he just conning us constantly, or is he just trying to get as much as he can get done within what he views as a very difficult political environment.
Someone who is astute out there should build an app for your iPhone that would let you do that. That would you could just hit the app and look into Obama's soul. I don't want to give away, the house here, but if there's some good software, that would be huge.
Right.
That would be huge. Yeah. Well, all right, so let me ask you.
Obama Soul app, yeah.
Let's take scenario one, the more optimistic scenario that Democrats are just really weak-kneed and it can never sell their agenda. What do we do as people who see ourselves outside of this sort of this, of that? What do we do? I mean,
well, I actually think the Tea Party was a very instructive lesson for progressives because, I mean, basically, a lot of the Tea Partiers, they didn't really wait for anyone to hand them anything. They just got in there and mixed it up, and the end result at times was craziness, Sharon Angle, Christine O'Donnell. But a lot of the end result was, new GOP congressmen and a lot of power inside the party. And basically, I think they show that doing pressure politics works and that if you want to get your agenda across, you basically have to advocate for it. And I think a lot of the progressive groups and a lot of the progressive thinkers basically just thought that if they could get a seat at the table, if they could negotiate with Obama, that he would listen to him. To them. And basically it seems clear that, they may not listen. And so I think there's going to have to be a more adversarial, confrontational approach going forward, and then that you're actually mobilizing people by doing that and that people are responding to you, then I think, the administration will be forced to react to that.
You have a good sense
whether they like it or not.
Right. Now you have a good sense of, let me ask you this. Do you have a good sense of the landscape where what groups might be best positioned to do something like that?
Well, there are a lot of groups out there. I mean, it's not like there is not a progressive or democratic infrastructure. There's Move On, there's Democracy for America. There's a whole host of groups out there with a lot of members. And it's just a question of, can they sharpen their focus? What all the Obama people that support him. I mean, do they care enough? I mean, it seems clear to me that, you know, Organizing for America, their post-campaign arm, basically, you know, is a one-way machine to support Obama's agenda. And to me, that seems totally insufficient, because if his agenda is not up to the task, then you have to have some way to push them. So will those Obama supporters find another outlet? Will they find a new group? Will they transform parts of the Democratic Party to be more adversarial? I mean, I'm not sure how it shakes out, but I don't think that they're starting from nothing. I mean, I think there's a fair amount there. It's just a question of, do they want to follow this strategy or not? And I'm not sure to what extent they do. I mean, you know, the Tea Party was a risky strategy. I mean, it all could have blown up in the Republicans' face, but they felt like they had nothing to lose anyway.
There's an advantage on the right too, is that, you know, the Koch brothers can come in and fund these people, and to the tune of literally, I think, tens of hundreds of millions of dollars, which helps.
I mean,
now I'm not saying
there's plenty of Democratic and progressive donors out there who could do this, though. I mean,
but the difference is that the Koch brothers know they're going to get a return on their. They're going to get a financial return. I mean,
of course, there's more self-interest on the Republican side,
absolutely.
No doubt about it.
And
but that doesn't mean that there isn't money on the Democrat side.
They also, when they're out of power, they have no problem with allowing their Frankensteins to become Frankensteins. It bit them in the ass when it came to immigration reform. Because more than anything, those big money corporations wanted that second tier of, you know, non-citizen but legal worker that they could exploit.
Yeah.
It bit them in the ass during immigration reform, but they're willing to let it run amok when they're out of power, in a way with an abandon that I just don't think that rational people, you know, responsible people do. You know, they're willing to basically, when they let this stuff, they unleash this stuff, they don't care that they're funding a significant percentage of these Tea Partiers are, you know, motivated by race or by the fact that Obama is a Muslim or by the fact that they don't mind that. That's part of the stew. They're willing to accept it. Whereas our wealthy, when they fund the equivalent on the left,
yeah,
there's a direct threat to them, because when that grows on the left, it is far more economic populist than it is on the right.
Yeah, no, it's true. It's true. But I mean, some of those, I would still say that some of those rich donors are okay with economic populism. I mean, they're okay in some ways. I mean, this has always been the tension in the Democratic Party, is, you know, wealthier donors, but they're willing to pay more higher taxes. I mean,
right.
So I think there is some agreement. I mean, I think most of the largest donors funding the party now want those tax cuts for the wealthy.
Of course.
To expire. I mean, maybe I'm being overly naive. I think there's certain taxes, like hedge fund taxes and things like that,
right.
that they're more sly on and they're more coy on, and people like Chuck Schumer are in the pocket of
right.
them, and it's very hard to do. But so I'm not saying it's everything, but I think there's enough agreement on enough stuff that going forward they could try to mobilize for this agenda. But the focus is just thus far not there yet.
Well, Ari, I appreciate your taking the time to talk about these things. The book, I'm going to try and see if I can – is it safe for me to take it out? Literally, when we had a little meltdown earlier in the show, we had to use it to prop up the computer. It's Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics. Ari Berman, folks, you blog all over the place, don't you?
Yeah, I blog for The Nation, and I blog for Huffington Post, too.
Where is your next book? Are you done with your book tour?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. Now I'm just in New York, chilling out a little bit, doing media.
All right, suit yourself. We could have had a lot of people come to your book tour. And if you run into any of those big podcasts...
No, but I'm still doing stuff. They should go to my website, herdingdonkeys.com, and they can see what's going on.
That's what I was looking for, buddy. Herdingdonkeys.com. I was setting you up there.
I should have thought about that. I know.
Herdingdonkeys.com. If you run into any of those big populist donors, tell them they should get a Majority Report membership.
I'll tell them to give you a call.
Thanks. All right. Ari Berman, thanks for joining us, Ari. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Sam. Congrats on the new show.
Thanks. Ari Berman, folks, definitely, this book is really, it's great. I mean, my two favorite books now written in recent years about the campaign, and Howard, the Herding Donkeys is about the Dean campaign, but it's also, it's more than that, and it really does get you thinking about this dynamic between outside and inside, and insurgent versus establishment. The Ustream camera's up. Do we have sound on it?
Ustream is up. I'm getting sound to it momentarily.
Okay.
And also, we've fixed everything that melted down beforehand. So.
All right, great. Evan's no longer having an ulcer right now.
Big props to Kyle for helping us out.
All right. That's it. We have the Cedar juggernaut rolls on. Let's go through a couple of quick stories. I know we're running a little bit late, but we lost a little time earlier. Now, of course, you guys who are podcasting, you have no idea. You have no idea. You miss the High Wire Act that is the show on a daily basis. The suspense. I got to get a suspense. This is not suspenseful. This song is not suspenseful. I'm trying to create a mise-en-scene here, and this is not suspenseful. Like the High Wire Act that we're on, that doesn't do it. No, that's not it either. No. Nope.
It sounds like Rosemary Clooney's High Wire Act.
Nice. Touche, Dorsey. Sweet. Really good job. folks, tomorrow's Wednesday, correct?
Oh, yeah.
On Wednesday, it is National Opt-Out Day. If you are flying, good fucking luck. I don't know how else to put that. We got somebody at the door. Go ahead. Let's answer it. Why not? We don't have a lobby here. Hi. How are you?
Oh, great. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
What are you guys doing?
We're doing a web show. This is not me. It was, yeah, we're new, so this is not us, but I don't know what to say. Who dropped it off for you?
No, man, I'm 11
or 3. Oh, okay. All right, thank you.
Bye, guys.
Bye. We are not whatever this place is. Okay, so be that as it may, tomorrow's National Opt-Out Day. That means that there's going to be people in front of you if you're going through those scanners. I don't know where are these scanners, are they everywhere now? No.
I'm not sure.
Most. I heard one person say, like, this is not a big deal. There's only something like 3% of travelers go through these scanners. Well, there are 2 million travelers a day. So 3% is like... It's like what, 60,000 people? Is that what it is? Right? A little more. 65,000 people a day. That's times three of... that's a lot of people a year. Right? I mean, officially. So this is a big deal. But listen, if you don't want to... if you don't want to go through the scanner because you don't want to get cancer, whatever wimpy reason you have, and you don't like people fondling you. Again, don't know if I can totally understand that. I hate getting massages, even from my wife. I just don't like, I don't like that. Just don't like it. I don't like the idea that my body has like other things underneath the skin. I don't like to be conscious of that because I go scarred by taking AP biology at too young an age and seeing what was happening with a fetal pig. So I don't like the idea of like anything that makes me conscious of muscle or sinew or bones. Like even when I say that, I think of that when Theismann got tackled. I can't even. So I don't like massages, but I love to be fondled. I love to be fondled because it's a little bit gentler. Doesn't make me feel conscious. Maybe it's like an intimacy issue that I have. I don't like to be massaged. I don't like the idea of deep tissue massage. I find really just distasteful. But fondling, I love. I love to be fondled. So this would not be an option I would take. I would avail myself of. But now you remember how Chertoff was one of his clients was RapeaScan, the company that makes these scanners. That's the name of it, right? RapeaScan?
Yes.
I'm not. No one has pointed out to me whether you pronounce it RapaScan or RapeaScan.
It depends on.
I'm from Massachusetts. We say RapeScan. I think
I think it's RapeScan, no matter what. You know.
And so he made money representing RapeScan to make sure they were part of the stimulus bill. And now, if you want to avoid that, you can go. Through a biometric verified ID system that will take you through the lines. You sort of sign up beforehand. You give them all your information. And you won't be molested. And it's only going to cost, $179. And the upshot of this is, guess who's an investor and sits on the board of directors of that company? Anybody?
Skeletor.
No? Was that your nickname for Chertoff?
Yeah, that was
surprise,
something.
Surprise.
Oh, my gosh. This dude's making it on both ends. I love it. That's like owning a brothel and a church. Right? It's like owning a casino and the franchise to Gambling's Anonymous. You get it on both ends, man. It doesn't matter. You're going to get paid. Ka-ching. Ka-ching! That's fantastic. This just did. Michael Chertoff making it on both ends. I found that song. I was looking for it yesterday.
That's totally the headlines, breaking news that Justin would use for...
Where do you think he got that?
That's why I'm just putting it all together.
Yeah, don't talk to me about how all my shit was exploited by somebody who literally thought it was funny, not an ironic way, to put rim shots after his jokes. I'm talking about Lionel.
I know you're
right?
About.
I mean, it wasn't like it sailed through irony back to oh my God. So from Kevin Cruz, one of our bloggers, he gives me some interesting facts. 5 to 10,000 terrorists in the world. This is according to the CIA. There's 1.5 billion Muslims. So the odds a Muslim is a terrorist is less than 150,000 to 1. Wow, that's... I mean, I know the guy who's sitting there going, that's not much of a spread. It's not so much, they're going, how many Muslims are in America? Well, it doesn't necessarily work that way. They're probably concentrated in other countries like the Sudan or Western Pakistan. The odds that a priest is, again, for Kevin Cruz, I can't verify this, but I think it sounds about right. Kevin Cruz has never let me down before. The odds that a priest is a child molester is around 1 in 20. The odds you'll die from cancer, 1 in 6. The odds you'll die from terrorism, 1, I think, in 6. Is this billion or trillion? 9 zeros. Let's put it that way.
Wow.
So, would you like some fondle with your cranberry sauce? This, this just in. The Vatican says the Pope's condom comments are not merely applicable to male prostitutes, but also to female prostitutes. That's just in. He's backtracked a little bit on his male prostitutes only comment. So I guess somebody must have... Can we check the YouTube subscriptions? Because I bet you we're going to find the Vatican subscribes to our YouTube feed. Because we put the Vatican story up on YouTube, and I bet you, the Vatican's watching our YouTube feed. They love that shit about Glenn Beck when I went down to the Glenn Beck thing, because I heard from... So, apparently, you know, after he talked about it was not despicable for gay prostitutes to use a condom, more or less. He's now, I think, sort of backed up and said it doesn't really matter what the gender is in terms of prostitutes. The important thing was that the person in question took into consideration the life of the other. So basically, the edict is this, which I think, you know, is it progress? Is it progress?
What are you talking about?
Well, what I'm saying is that it's a little bit of progress if the Vatican... broadens their condom comments to apply to women. The Pope is saying that the condom use in heterosexual relations is a lesser evil than passing HIV onto a partner. Well, you know what? I think that is progress. That's going to get the fanfare. The Pope now says that preventing the spread of a deadly disease is less bad than having a condom on you when you're having sex and could procreate. You know, that 0.04% chance of you procreating even with a condom on. Speaking of that healthcare reform, the Obama administration is now... I mean, this is the interesting thing. At this point in the Obama administration, the game is executive orders, executive agencies carrying out the legislative accomplishments, be they as they may, of the past 2 years. Yesterday, the 22nd, was the beginning of the phase-in of some of those rules for health care. The health care law promises consumers that insurers must spend at least $4 out of $5 they collect through premiums on direct medical services. In other words, $1 out of every $5 can be used for administrative costs and profits, I guess, presumably, and advertising. Basically puts a cap on their expenditures. Health plans will have to disclose many details about how they allot their money, calculate the portion of their spending that promotes good health. That promotes good health. And if they devote too much of their income to the wrong purposes, give consumers refunds. Now, there are a couple of concessions that these regulations make. New and small health plans will have extra time to implement these rules. States may ask for federal permission to exempt from the rules health plans sold to individuals, which is apparently a small but expensive and shaky part of the insurance market, if they can prove that meeting requirements would prompt such plans to stop doing business with the state. So in Republican states, you will see more exemptions. That's my guess. For a large group of employees that make up most of the insurance market, at least 85% must go to coverage. For policies sold to individuals, small group, it's 80%, but still, that's a benefit. Now, consumers groups, advocacy groups for patients hailed this victory. There is one potential downfall. And again, when you have this type of governmental policy, sometimes you have to wait and see what happens. And then hopefully there'll be some amendments to it. There is some criticism that what insurance companies could do is remove cost controls. Remove cost controls, in other words, essentially allow for more, cover more medical plans, programs, uses, devices, treatments, increasing the cost of care across the board, which would mean that they're, because they only have to deal with a percentage, balloon their premiums to cover those costs, and it would increase their share, that 20%, I guess, in which they would have more money to spend and administer. Does that make sense, Dorsey?
Absolutely.
No, seriously. Do you get what I'm saying?
No.
Okay. Well, you got to tell me the truth, because if I'm not being clear, I want to be clear here. If I charge you $10 a year for your health care premiums, I won't. It's more expensive than that, and frankly, I wouldn't cover a guy like you. So I can see you have a lot of health care risks. I must spend $2. Oh, I have a cap of $2 that I can spend paying myself, advertising, hiring Evan to do the paperwork. All right? And I allow you $8. $8 of that $10 goes towards your care. If I take off cost controls and I can say, okay, now you know what? Remember before how I didn't let you get a CAT scan? Or remember before how I didn't let you get a crown put on your tooth? Because apparently my insurance doesn't cover crowns, just maintenance. Well, you can have that now. And you're like, okay, great. Well, now the cost of your care goes up. I can raise your premium to $20, right? Because now your care costs $16 a year. That means I get $4 to which to get my profits from and to pay Evan, even though there isn't substantially more. You know, I'm not going to pay Evan anymore. Maybe I can hire another Evan, but for one more dollar. And that means I have $3 in which to take profit, or you know, $2 as opposed to $1 before. You understand that by increasing the cost of your care, because it's based on a percentage, then I can make more money. You'll get more care, and it won't necessarily help with decreasing the cost of medical expenditures across the board, but you will at least get more care for it. So that percentage will always be there. Some people suspect that's the game the insurance companies are going to play. But now if they go down that road, they're incentivizing more healthcare reforms, which sometimes you got to go through a little rain to get to when the ground is soggy.
So I should keep seeing the witch doctor and tell them.
You don't have health insurance, do you?
No.
Do you, Evan?
Because there's some New Jersey laws for the next, like, 6 months.
Wait, how old are you?
I'm young.
How old are you?
I'm 25.
It's not New Jersey laws, dude.
Well, it used to be, but now it's federal.
Now it's a federal law. You're on your program to... Are you blushing?
No.
Oh. I can't believe how effing young you guys are. How old are you, Dorsey?
I'm old.
How old?
33.
All right, that's encouraging.
That's better, right?
Yeah, that makes me feel better. 25, Jesus. You got to be kidding me. This is interesting. Emin Sullivan commented, good to have you back, Sam, on Facebook. Good to have you back, although I'm Irish. And the IMF might be coming to take our country, and I might not be able to afford internet in a few days. Well, he wrote that a couple of days ago, and, well,
surprise.
And congratulations to you, sir. The IMF has come in and has essentially, I guess the loan is coming from the EU and the IMF. Oh, wow. People are very excited about that. EU has bailed out Ireland. Apparently, protesters tried to storm the parliament building. The prime minister has been forced to call an election. And the IMF is basically saying, hey, you know what you should do? You know how you got all those unemployed people because your economy is so bad? And you know how you've given, you know, literally millions upon millions of dollars to the bankers to salvage the financial system, which apparently didn't work with your economy. And I'm sure those bankers will give that money back, right? They'll give that money back.
Hey, what happened?
Well, the IMF is saying to Ireland, you should gradually lower unemployment benefits and cut the level of your minimum wage in order to boost employment. So instead of giving whatever it is, $25,000 per person to the bankers, you could have given it to your people who are out of work, or and they could have pumped that money right into the economy. But that would be, of course, would be against the Irish edict, I guess. I don't know. IMF also urged Spain to lower severance pay on permanent contracts. And for Portugal, it recommended the country cut severance payments and resume privatization process. And, oh, and just in case you were curious as to what the IMF said back in 2006, these geniuses. Back in 2006, on to Ireland, this is via Atrios. The outlook for the financial system is positive in Ireland. There are several macro risks and challenges facing the authorities, but as long as the housing market has boomed, household debt to GDP ratio has continued to rise, raising some concern about credit risks. Further, a significant slowdown in economic growth, while seen as highly unlikely, would have adverse consequences for banks' non-performing loans. However, and this is the good news if you're Ireland in 2006 that the IMF wants to tell you, stress tests confirm that the major financial institutions have adequate capital buffers to cover a range of shocks.
Don't piss down my back and tell me it's raining.
I guess it didn't work out that way. Well, what were other geniuses saying about the Irish economy back in 2008? Do we have some type of find what the geniuses were saying about Ireland back in 2008 and why they were doing so well?
In Ireland, the corporate tax rate is 11%. So ours is 35%. Ireland is 11%. Ireland's a beautiful country, as you well know. So businesses and corporations sometimes will go to those other countries and set up operations there because of the lower tax rates. Now, ours is the second highest in the world. Only Japan is higher, and the Japanese economy has not been a model, obviously.
Our high tax rate today means that some corporations are going to say, let's go somewhere else instead of America. That's the wrong thing. We ought to get our tax rate down to a more competitive level. Look what low tax rates have done for Ireland.
Our tax rates for business in America is 35%. Ireland, it's 11%. Where are companies going to go where they can create jobs and where they can do best in business? We need to cut the business tax rate in America. We need to encourage business now. Of all times in America, we need to cut people's taxes. We need to encourage business, create jobs, not spread the wealth around.
Well, we certainly managed not to spread the wealth around. Now, of course, both Mitt and McCain are lying there. Tax rates may be there, but we are around like, I think, 12th on the list of industrialized nations in terms of actual tax rates. The actual amount that is paid. The effective tax rates. Good thing nobody listened to those two geniuses. Can't wait till Mitt Romney runs again with all his laundered money. Some quick news. This is not breaking. Oh, but that is far more appropriate, actually. Justice Department examining whether employees of New York-based investment bank Goldman Sachs leaked information about deals to select clients. Let me see. My guess would be, But I'm not a prosecutor or an investigator. I don't know. On Monday, the Federal Bureau of Investigation raided three hedge funds in connection with insider trading investigation. Some interesting studies on NAFTA. University of Virginia economist John McLaren and Shashank Huckabayan used the 1990 and 2000 census data to determine that a worker with no high school graduate, high school dropouts in the apparel industry, whose 16.6 tariff was eliminated by NAFTA, saw wage growth rate about 11 points less, percentage points less, than a worker in a business that didn't depend on high tariffs. In other words, NAFTA did hurt workers at the lower end of the education spectrum. Blue-collar workers in vulnerable industries suffered large absolute declines in real wages as a result of the agreement.
Surprise!
That large sucking sound, ladies and gentlemen, was jobs filtering their way to Mexico, which, of course, all ended up in China and sent millions of migrant Mexican workers across the border in an attempt to feed their families. So we managed to screw both Americans and Mexicans with NAFTA. So kudos to our establishment leaders. I'm looking at you, Bill Clinton. And on a cheery note, ladies and gentlemen, a much happier note, jurors began deliberating Monday in the money laundering trial of Tom DeLay, former House Majority Leader who was forced to resign 5 years ago. Closing arguments, prosecutors said Mr. DeLay had plotted with two political operatives in 2002 to illegally channel $190,000 in corporate donations to races for the Texas legislature. The one law in Texas, there's no other laws about elections, is that corporate money cannot go into state races. So DeLay did what he believes is still not illegal. He took corporate money, sent it to a federal PAC, and then the federal PAC, from a different bank account, because we all know that money is not fungible. When you put money into your bank account, they transfer it into another account. It has to be the same actual dollars. Like the actual check has to go in there for it to be the same money. And then he sent that money back to races in Texas. Evidence showed that DeLay did this, and he's not even arguing it. His lawyer is just arguing that the money swap was legal and that the corporate money never reached the candidates. And then he also, just to hedge himself, said that DeLay was a figurehead who did not worry about himself with details of his committee's activities. Now, I don't know how to read this because they didn't follow up on this, but during jury deliberations, and I think it turns on this, the jury indicated in notes to the judge that they had questions about how money laundering, because he's being charged on money laundering violations, not campaign finance, because he essentially laundered that money. They want to know if it could apply to legal donations. Can it constitute money laundering if the money wasn't procured by illegal means? So in other words, you know, if you're a drug dealer and you send your money down to a Cayman Island Bank, no offense to the Cayman Islands. If you want to send me there, if the Cayman Islands want to send me a free trip down there, I will go. And I will reverse myself as soon as I see how beautiful it is. You're a drug dealer. You send that money down to the Cayman Islands. They send you back money. You can be charged with money laundering in addition to the illicit nature of your deriving that money. If the judge says, no, you can derive that money through legal means, and still be charged with money laundering, I think, Tom DeLay, you will have a delay in your ability to walk around freely. Huh?
That's a good one, Tim.
Thank you. A new study cites the economic benefits of the DREAM Act. 2.1 million undocumented immigrants would become legalized and generate approximately $3.6 trillion over a 40-year period. These are people who did not break a law. Do you understand this? When we talk about the children of illegal immigrants, they did not break a law. They were either born in this country or did not come into this country under their own volition.
If they were born in the country, they'd be citizens, wouldn't they?
That's right. So they must have come into this country not on their own volition. It's like a, juvie, I guess. And I don't even know if it's an offense if you're underage. I just don't know that it is. It's not even a criminal violation to be here illegally. It's a civil violation. I think even less criminal, technically speaking, than if you were to buy your medication from Canada. I wonder how many people buy their medication from Canada and refer to themselves as illegal drug users or illegal seniors. I'm an illegal senior citizen. And it would generate $3.6 trillion. And Pat Garofalo over at the Wonk Room says, by 2025, according to estimates by the Lumina Foundation, our nation will be short 16 million college-educated workers. The Dream Act sends very narrowly deserving people to college. Folks, that is it. We went a little long today if you're listening to the live show because we had a little snafu. Tomorrow on the program, Matt Taibbi. Still working on what Thursday and Friday are going to be. Thursday may be some Chalmers Johnson interviews. Maybe some Cedar on Sunday special book shows on Thursday and Friday. Monday we'll be back live. If you can afford to become a member and I don't know how you can sit there and know that Marc Maron has more subscribers than I do. I mean, talk about the outrage, the injustice. This is America. And in America, Marc Maron should not have more memberships than me.
If that, charged.
Let that be your inspiration. All right, folks, Sammy Cam is in effect at Majority.fm, and I will take your IMs at Majority.fm. All right, we'll be right back after this. Just a brief moment or two. We may even switch computers. Or no. Forget it. We'll be right back. Technical problems today, but the upshot of those technical problems is that we have resolved these technical problems, I think, for once and for all. And you know, I like this new camera angle over here, and I like this camera angle on the Sammy Cam. I mean, maybe we could, you know, maybe we could have the same camera angle for both, but we only use the Sammy Cam during the after show, and we don't use that during the after show. I don't think we had anything good today for YouTube. Maybe I would cut down that first segment on the Irish thing. It's not directly correlated, but it's nice to hear those guys how ridiculous they were. May I suggest the Cayman Island tourism song be added to your 360 machine for when you talk about corporate tax rates? That's a good idea. Thank you, Nefertiti. Rusty. Okay, Harold. Cam looks great.
Good. Awesome. Good.
I like it. Let me see if I can check it out. Go to the Majority Report, see if I can see it myself.
I don't know. It's a little green to me.
Does it look a little green?
I'm just fanning the flames.
Thanks, oh, man. I see. Listen to this email I got from somebody. Wow, it's
a lot of computers in that frame.
Right, there we go. Oh, wait, I'm looking at an ad. The where is that? Oh, did I just lose it? I got a ridiculous email. Some guy writes at 1:39 in the afternoon. Okay, 10 minutes after the show is over. Wait a second. Is that the angle of the, was it tilted like that?
Yeah, we're there's a metric card trying to level it out, stuck underneath the thing. We're working on it.
That's incredibly tilted.
It was more tilted before.
All right. I don't understand why that's so tilted. Like, what is going on? You know what?
The camera itself is taped in.
I think
angle.
The camera's, just turn the camera. You don't need, it's not, well, untape it. You can untape it. You can show around. Show people the. Don't worry. It's gonna be funny. There you go. So the guy emails me at 1:39. A response to my email blast about the show. How come you're not talking about AIPAC and the lawsuit that's facing them? What is it too controversial for you to deal with? And it was really one of the only stories I had done yesterday. Did we cut that up?
No.
You know what, dude?
Yeah, let's run that.
Cut that one up. And so I emailed him back, and I said, you should really listen to the show before you send me an email like this. And then he writes back, oh, sorry, I don't have the internet. How do I listen to the show? And then he sends me another email saying, good job. How do I access the show on the web? Like, I think he's confused me with somebody else. I don't. God, I am. Harold says the tilt is cool. Very 60s Batman. Yeah, that's true. Scanners aren't everywhere. Okay. Well, Harold, hang in there. You know, go through the checker thing. I mean, you have these scanners at Heathrow, and they use them, and it's not that big of a deal. But I, for one, am just happy that people. Hopefully, this is like a gateway into people's consciousness about their civil liberties. I tend to doubt it. I think. People talk civil liberties in this country. They're basically mad about the voting procedures on Dancing with Stars or whatever. Wow. Sugar High, will you send that in an email to samcedarshow.com? I don't think we'll be doing a 24-hour broadcast like the Young Turk stream, but... Huh. Sourceforge.net. IDJC. Look this up. Oh, you can't. You don't have a computer.
I have a computer. Fix it.
IDJC.sourceforge.net. Todd Slater. Sound level is extremely low.
It's because we're running off the backup computer and kind of did that in a rush.
Can you raise it on the board?
I can. It might peak a little bit. I'll bring it up a little bit.
All right.
But tomorrow, everything's gonna be ready.
You just mentioned Lionel and his rim shots. Too funny, albeit in a nauseating way. Man, does that guy suck! I'll never forget the day he took over your morning slot. I think the first 3 minutes was all I heard. Didn't he call Rachel a thick neck lesbian? I think he did at one point back in on his WOR show. Yeah, play his Gypsy King's theme song for your old time's sake, would you? Sound is fine on the Sammy Cam, though, Todd Slater says. Was that what his song was? Lionel, 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 Lionel. It was Gypsy Kings?
Yeah. It didn't say Lionel.
What were they saying?
I don't know, but I remember several people in the chat room saying, you know, just letting everybody know that it wasn't actually saying Lionel's name.
Whatever. That dude is on Ed Schultz's show?
Yeah, he usually brings him in on Fridays for the last 5 minutes.
Everybody's so insane! It's like playing Russian roulette with a drunk guy. It's like, all right, it's like white Russian roulette. That guy's a big drinker, isn't he, Dorsey?
From what I hear, he never went to Studio C with us, so... Never really got to see him in action.
I wonder if there was a single morning where he was sober. But that doesn't matter. That doesn't matter at all. That's fine. That's fine. I don't mean I'm not going to judge him if he has a drinking problem. I judge him more on just his incredible lack of entertainment value. Daddy Zeng, Cheridoff and Abramoff both end in off. Coincidence? Pluger, cam feedback. Cam lighting is yellow-green, but also tilted. Yes. Our lighting situation on the cam is bad. We have fluorescent lights here, and the cam is tilted. That's correct. Both of those are correct. Obama's failure to assign blame. Could the Republicans really have been any more partisan were Obama to have actively pursued investigations of the Bush criminality on war, et cetera? I agree with you. It does not make any sense to me. And the people who judge him, you know, would have judged Obama as being too partisan are going to judge him that way anyways. Base thought they were supporting a constitutional lawyer critical of the Bush administration and violations of basic rights. Got a president defending those same policies for the most part. That's I can't argue with that. More volume, says Matthew. Hard to hear. Whoops. We've got to, I would risk getting hot, then no volume.
Sounds good. Getting it done.
Svengali, no economics today, Sam. Yesterday I had a run-in with a neo-Nazi who insisted that I, as a Jew, was a member of a worldwide conspiracy involving puppet governments, bankers in Zurich, and other typical things. He says on my secret I am. This sounds really awesome. This, of course, is a joke. I'm making up this I am does not even exist. This is all fabrication.
Yes, Svengali. Continue.
This sounds really awesome, and I'm somewhat disappointed I wasn't invited. Did I miss the Jew facts on this? I love the way he's playing it off. Is there any way I can still apply? I really have a lot to offer on my resume.
Jeez, I got to be careful. This is the power strip. I'm kicking around here for the entire operation.
There, you got to probably mount that. I really have a lot to offer on my resume for the worldwide Jewish conspiracy. Does that being an atheist disqualify me? No, it depends. Check on your just like on your right sort of kidney area. Do you have a tattoo? Do you have a secret tattoo? Oh, also, can you explain why the hell the news is talking about people in Korea having a slap fight? It's really interrupting my coverage of Dancing with Stars. Right. Well, we actually forgot to bring that up in during our meltdown. I don't know what to offer that people can't find somewhere else, frankly. But apparently there's a hot war now going on with the Koreans. You know, all this stuff from North Korea is looking for attention, which leads me to believe that they're on, you know, in the brink of economic chaos.
Yeah.
They, you know, the other day there was that report about their centrifuges. And the report came from an invitation that North Korea gave to a scientist to come and check it out. So, they obviously wanted us to know about it. And now they're firing, missiles or mortars.
Yeah, they were shelling an island off the coast.
You know, that's what we call a clear sign that someone is asking for help. But yes, I mean, two people died. It's obviously not. And it could in some ways escalate. But my sense is, and I haven't read anything on this, any analysis, and I know, you know, about as little about the dynamic between North Korea and South Korea as possible. But it sounds to me like North Korea is on the brink of some type of economic disaster or food disaster and want to get the Americans back to the table. and are willing to go to great lengths to do so. But meanwhile, on Dancing with the Stars, let's get back to the important stuff. You know, there's a lot of people who think that, Svengali, about the worldwide conspiracy. It's growing. Did I cover Mitch McConnell's hypocrisy? Oh, yeah, we'll definitely have Chris Hayes on. McConnell's hypocrisy in Iraq. No, I didn't see that, actually. Justin Elliott's story.
Yeah, something about Bush. He was lobbying Bush to get out of Iraq while he was simultaneously making fun of Democrats for wanting to get out of there.
Sure, of course.
Bush brought that up in his book.
That's not surprising. Klug P, play that McCain Ireland 11% income tax every day audio too. Peace be mit with you. 1 in 55 U.S. residents will die in an automobile accident within their lifetime. Sound is horrible. Too hot or muddy too much at 12:40. It's a problem going from my computer. Check out the Sammy Cam. We'll give you the best. Oh, my God. Look at. I got a spam bot on the. I should have known. Well, no. There's no way for me to know that. Baby Buttercup is not an IMer. My profile is, how do I block this person? Block. Sorry, Baby Buttercup. You're gone. Don't be a putz. To get a sense of where the Democratic Party is really coming, issues of economic populism, look back at who vote for the Graham-Leach bailout. Yes, the repeal of Glass-Steagall. The Senate was 99 Dems voting yes, including Dodd, Lieberman, Biden, Leahy, Ted Kennedy, John Kerry, Harry Reid. This is the People's Party. Trivia, there are only three senators who voted no, still in office. Boxer, Kolsky, and Shelby. Huh, interesting. Kevin semicolon, Barbara Bush is walking back the fetus story. Now she's laying blame on the housekeeper. Classic WASP move. Fantastic. The housekeeper showed Bush the fetus.
The housekeeper left the fetus around. I specifically told her to return the fetus to the mantle.
When are you going to be on Dancing with the Stars? As soon as I can get on, my man. As soon as I can get on. Crystal Count. You know how Ari Berman laid out the Democrats and Obama think the Republicans will play ball now that they had the government, so the Democrats just have to try harder, cut the deficit, and get away from that tax and spendiness? And you know how colon-blowingly insane that sounds to you, me, and anyone with a frontal lobe? Well, I think the fact that Ari himself takes that view even slightly seriously shows you how deeply the establishment disease runs. Unbelievable and hopeless. I don't think Ari buys that.
I didn't get that sense.
No. I mean, look, Ari is a reporter first and foremost. I mean, he also has analysis, but he does, you know, and he takes certain things at face value. And then I think he'll, you know, he believes they believe that. Which I think, you know, it's hard to not do in Ari's position unless you have evidence to the contrary. Now, I don't know what he really believes, but I think he expressed some doubt about it. He said it's possible that they don't even believe that. Did you cover how Barbara Bush had to come out and explain that she's not a fetus pickler, but rather the housekeeper was? It's beyond farce. I didn't. I just found that. Dradmanthes. Hey, Sam, great show. You mentioned the Pope again. I was thinking you were too quick to disregard his change in position. Look, he's already expanded from every sperm is sacred position to male's hooker sperm is not sacred, and now female hooker's John's sperm is not sacred. Before you know it, there'll be very little sacred semen left out there. I think I gave him credit for that. Can you please turn up the gain a little bit at 108? On Lionel's first show, a caller wanted to talk about caging lists. Lionel made fun of him, asking why the caller was concerned about Cajun lists. Smug, smarmy, SOB. Yes, and stupid. Not bright. Not funny. The best was when he came in, he's like, I'm all about ratings. That was his big, you know, like, I'm going to stick it to these guys. I'm all about ratings. Let me tell you something. Not only did ratings plummet, the number of live affiliates he had were cut by two-thirds within, I think, a book or two. I was expanding my affiliates. I had grown one or two affiliates within one book. I had been taken off for Stephanie Miller and then replaced after a fan outcry. You know, small affiliate in like Asheville or something like that. And I was, I think, like 100. My ratings were up 120%. They fired me before the second book came out. They were up. They were both up. But the second book, the first really, really full book. I mean, first book I had was short of a week or two in September. But the numbers were good. The second book was even better, but they fired me before then.
Geniuses.
Yeah. What are you going to do? Okajik. That email guy sounds as confused as Dewey. Could it be him? Audio is fine on my PC. Laptop speakers are good, though. That's at 109. Jay Bullisk. Hey, Sam. Joe here in Kentucky. Glad you're back on the air. Are Lionel and Alex Bennett the same person? No, at least Alex Bennett, I think I like his politics better, even though his show may be, I haven't heard it. But, I mean, you know, there's a generational divide. And a comedic divide. Like, there's a slight generational and sensibility divide. Then I'd argue talent divide. So there's a generational, a sensibility, and a talent divide. And a centurial. Can you say that? And an ideological divide. There's just those four divides. Taurus-y. Jim DeMint, Tom Coburn, a calling fellow. Republicans allow ethanol subsidies to expire. Good for them. Even a broken clock, right? And he says, now watch for farm state Dems like Kent Conrad to oppose the expiration. Right. We have to be so fiscally prudent, unless we're being electorally prudent, says Kent Conrad. All right, folks. Short one today. We had a little bit of economic, technical. Speaking of Stephanie Miller, what happened that one day in New York when she was on instead of you? What was going on there? Oh, you know, that was a battle that had nothing to do with me. Air America owned or rented part of... Air America had like 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. at that time. And it was a negotiation tactic by WRL. That had really nothing to do with me. It's just that 9 to 11 was the easiest way for them to send a message. It had nothing to do with Stephanie. Stephanie was on in New York for a while, for an hour a day. But I think they found that it was too expensive. You know, that's the way that radio works a lot of times, is that you either put your show on a station for free or you pay to be on and then you sell your ad inventory. A lot of people do that. That's you know, one aspect of the business. But it had nothing to do with me. Although I was pissed at Air America because it is a classic fuck-up on management part. I don't remember what day it was that I accidentally punched a hole in the wall. Did you ever see? You saw that hole, right?
Yes, I saw the hole.
I bet Lauren remembers.
I don't know if Lauren was there. Or I can't remember. I think it was the day that they forgot or didn't pay the 800 number. So we had no fucking phones. And it was just like, it was so tense around there. Or it was either the phones or it was like I got bumped and, you know, whatever it was. So retarded. But someday I'm going to tell that Mark Green story.
Oh, yeah.
But we need to have Chris Rose in here because I want to get hit because he was watching it on the security cams.
Was that the day that you had a conversation with him across the office?
Correct.
Yeah, I remember that. That was awesome.
That was the day that I was told. This was during Randy's suspension. And I've talked about Randy's suspension that, you know, I spoke to Randy on the phone before going on. I told them, please don't do this. And then I was down in D.C. for something, and I'm down in D.C., and I get, you know, a call in the middle of the night that Randy has quit or something like that. I was coming up to New York the next day, and they asked me to go on, and I said, well, who's going to get this job? We haven't made any decisions, blah, blah, blah. You'll be the first to know. I said, you know, please, just keep me informed. Don't, you know, the new owner. And I thought, you know, I wanted to show that I was a team player because apparently sometimes I come off as not a team player in some circumstances. When the team is full of fucking morons, I tend not to be a team player. When the team is just playing for the individuals, like they're all just going for their own personal stats and not even actually going on the court, they're just paying off the scorekeeper. And I get promised up and down, we're going to be straight with you, you be straight with us, you know, all these sort of like platitudes. And I get on the air like 3 hours after having this conversation with the owner, who's now gone. I'm assured by the president at that time of the network. It was Mark Green. He was the president. Pull up a hail to the chief. Can you do that?
I don't know if I can find one.
Actually, I heard from the guy who made the From the Desk of Cedar logo on Twitter. That From the Desk of Cedar was a mocking of Mark Green's From the Desk of. And literally, I'm on air. People are, it's the first time they're hearing about Randy quitting. People are enraged and completely justifiably so. And, you know, the last laugh was Randy's because Air America lost like 80% of its clearance, never regained it, spent a lot more on Montel Williams, never regained it. It's a complete disaster for Air America. Really, the beginning, the genuine beginning of the end. I just don't think it was possible to recover. And particularly with the decision they made following that. And I am that it's being reported on Huffington Post that there's going to be a series of celebrity hosts starting with Richard Belzer on Monday. I'm IM'd by Sammy Kammer. Like, they put me on air. I'm actually getting, like, and I'm realizing like this, I'm trying to do the show, and I'm realizing like, they put me on air and then leaked to the Huffington Post information that I didn't know. That, you know, they put me out there into this meat grinder and then went leaked information to the high. And you know, there's only one person who operates like that. Because if it was a radio person doing this, they wouldn't have leaked to the Huffington Post. And nobody would even think to, like, what is the value? Like, what? Leak? Why don't we just announce it? We have a radio station. We have a way to reach our listeners. That's, to, you know, but somebody wanted some type of publicity value out of it about the suspension of Randy and this and that. And, of course, it was that moron. I'll leave the story there. I'll have to complete it another day. I'll leave the story there because I want Chris here because I need Chris to sort of like, because then we can actually tell the story almost like at a two camera angle. You know what I'm saying?
The silent movie version.
Right. Because he saw it on the security cam at that point.
When we have him on for the next Casual Friday.
What was the other story I was just going to tell? I don't know. They'll come up eventually. Just more, you know, talking out of school. Neffer, she remembers this day well. I think somebody has the Sammy Cam up on YouTube. Believe it or not, people telling me sincerely that it's not so bad. It's much more helpful than the usual get over it wuss. Oh, good. Tomorrow's the last show of the week. Happy holidays. Thank you. Well, it'll be the last live one probably. Oh, Jetpack Engaged Espresso. Yes.
That's good.
Forgot to mention Just Coffee today. We were so hectic. I mean, I hope you guys are buying Just Coffee. It great Hanukkah gift. Great Hanukkah gift. Dorsey, did you hear that? Jetpack Express. Can you make one?
Yeah.
Just Coffee in the background or the Majority Report logo in the background with a Jetpack Engage?
Absolutely.
Or something like that. And we'll send it to Just Coffee. That's a great one. Pluger, brilliant. Pluger's like practically a producer of this show so far. All right, folks. Was Randy's firing not motivated by a difference in political views between Green and Randy? Wait, it's a double negative. Was Randy's firing not motivated by a difference in political views between... Randy's firing was motivated by the fact that she would tell Green, you're an idiot, to his face. And Green didn't like that. And so he basically took the goose that laid the golden eggs and said, you're rude. You're not a team player, even though you're the only thing that's making this team win. So for the sake of chemistry, yes, okay, we'll have a losing season for the next 10. But for the sake of chemistry, a moron. It's because Green was an idiot. Everything he did was because he was an idiot. Cross-referenced with the idea that he thought he was a genius. And if you have those two combinations, if you can combine both sheer idiocy with total arrogance, you can do just about nothing. No one can stop you from accomplishing nothing. Unless, of course, you have a billionaire brother. Right? I mean, isn't that the calculation? Yeah, Dorsey's even afraid to say, like, nope.
He kind of got me my job at night.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, no. I mean, I'm sure he's a very nice man. I'm sure he's a nice man. I think he is.
However, I think
he's a very sweet father and a loving husband.
I do remember working the phones that day and days after Randy's firing at Air America. Jesus God, the thing never stopped ringing. Like all
right.
day long for
of course.
Like 2 weeks.
Of course.
They're pissed.
Of course. I mean, I think Green saw an opportunity to help ingratiate himself with the Clinton campaign and to, you know, I don't think it had anything to do with political views. I mean, it had to do all with, like, sort of small politics, personal politics.
Absolutely.
Huge waste. Ah, well. When are you going to have Kent Jones and that character of his on? Oh, what's that name? Lawton Smalls?
Lawton Smalls.
I'll tell you when I'm going to do it. When I have more members than Marc Maron. If you have NBO on demand, I can recommend a couple of docs. I don't even know what the hell that means. Third in Delaware by the makers of Jesus Camp. If you have NBO on demand.
I think they meant H. It's close to the N on a keyboard.
Oh, HBO on demand. Third in Delaware. By the Jesus Camp. Outrage. Outrage? Excuse me, don't be a putz. Why don't you Google Sam Cedar and Kirby Dick? buddy. That did that dude practically did a book of FUBAR, and I interviewed him on Break Room Live. I still got it. All right, folks. We will see you tomorrow on the program, Matt Taibbi. Oh, and, shoot, forgot to ask for emails. We're going to have to put this out on Twitter. Send me emails, problems that you're having with your family, right-wing memes, narratives. I will tackle them all. It'll be a show especially dedicated to that. Maybe we're going to get a guest, special guest. Might have a right-wing father. I gotta check and see if she's available. See you tomorrow. I get somewhere the choice is made.